Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Through months of worry over Europe's debt crisis, it's been quite frankly all Greek to me. But just when it's finally looking like the Greek government has been saved from defaulting on its mountain of debt, new concerns are lurking over other countries. Will Italy be next? And still unanswered, just how vulnerable do some European banks remain? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Innocentive, solving important problems for business, government, and foundations by connecting them to problem solvers from around the world. Innocentive.com, where the world innovates. And by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the internet. Reputation.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us this Thursday, the 27th of October. And today we can look at Greece from a new angle. Up to now, we've explored the effect of that country's sovereign debt crisis on its people and on the rest of the world, and a lot of the stories have been somber. So it was nice to get some potentially good news on that front today. EU leaders burned the midnight oil last night and hashed out a solution to Europe's sovereign debt crisis. They emerged this morning with a new deal they say could save the euro. It takes an axe to Greece's debt burden and pushes the banks to raise more money. But as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London, it still may not be enough.
It's a complicated deal with three elements. First, Greece gets some relief. Banks are being asked to write off half what they lent the government in Athens. And, says Harry Samuel of the Royal Bank of Canada, it looks like the banks will comply.
Most, if not all, the banks have agreed the 50% write down on their Greek debt holdings. So actually, that's one part of the announcement this morning that, from the market's perspective, was quite clear.
But the second part of the deal is a bit more doubtful. The banks will be required to raise about 100 billion euros in extra capital so they can absorb these losses without collapsing. Louise Cooper of BGC Partners claims it's not enough.
Well, actually, double that needs to be put into European banks. It's all done a little bit on the cheap. I want to see shock and awe. We haven't got that.
And then there's the agreement to more than double the size of the bailout fund to $1.4 trillion to protect Italy from defaulting. It's not clear where the extra cash will come from. China and Brazil have been mooted. Philip Booth of the Institute for Economic Affairs is not impressed.
It seems to me to be clutching at straws, really, to be expecting other governments to provide this capital. And if they do provide this capital, given the risks that are involved, presumably it will come at a pretty big cost.
Others argue that today's deal doesn't really address the fundamental flaw in the euro which caused the crisis, the wide divergence in performance between the member states. Sunny Kapoor of the Redefine think tank.
They have stopped the euro from collapsing today, or even perhaps tomorrow, but they definitely haven't saved the euro. We are still in the thick of trouble. We are not out of the woods.
Stock markets around the world greeted the euro debt deal with near euphoria today, but we have seen such enthusiasm before, after earlier bailouts, and it soon faded. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
So what's on the minds of Greek Americans now as they look across the ocean and ponder the austerity measures being imposed on their native land? We decided to check at the local L.A. spot for moussaka and baklava, Papa Christos.
My name is Chris Chris. I'm the proud owner of C&K Importing and Papa Christos. Our business is Greek products, and we have to purchase euros. So if the euro goes up, my products obviously are higher because I need to spend more dollars to buy the euros.
A lot of the Greeks in Greece, they have been spoiled, you know. Pension for this, pension for that.
People are leaving. I know people, families are leaving to go to Cyprus. So as far as my family is concerned, that's what they're planning on doing because some of them have really been affected already and there's still all the cuts haven't taken place yet.
That was Chris Lambrosovardis, and Dimitra Koutsos. We found them at Papa Christo's, a Greek restaurant in Los Angeles. Wall Street was downright giddy today, and not just over the improving outlook in Europe. Our gross domestic product is looking better, too. That's the way we measure overall economic activity, goods and services, manufacturing, housing costs, government spending. Lump all that together, and it turns out GDP was up 2.5% in the third quarter, twice the growth eked out in the quarter before. But still, not enough to make an appreciable dent in unemployment. And last quarter's growth came at some cost. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Americans went shopping this summer. Spending increased a healthy 2.4%, which is amazing in the face of a simultaneous drop in income, continuing high unemployment, and pessimism about the future.
I think Americans are sort of getting tired of being so frugal.
Brown University's David Weiss says consumers spending money, even when it means dipping into their savings, is just what the economy needs, at least for the time being.
But in the long run, well, that's what got us into this mess. We were living beyond our means during the last decade, and we don't want to get into that trap again. So it's trying to tread this fine line between short-term need for stimulus and long-term need for prudence.
How long can shoppers keep shelling out more than they earn? Standard & Poor's economist Beth Ann Bovino says since the recession, Americans got rid of a lot of credit card debt and began saving, socking away twice as much. She thinks that'll continue.
So it does look like while we are spending a bit more, people are very aware of what's in their balance sheets, and I don't think they're going back to the go-go days.
Businesses are beginning to respond to the new consumer demand. Investments in new plant and equipment grew more than 16% last quarter. David Weiss expects demand to stay strong, especially if oil prices fall.
Money you spend at the gas pump is money you can't spend at the department store. So during the fourth quarter, hopefully we'll be spending a little less at the gas pump.
Which means, he says, you should be hearing less talk about a double-dip recession. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The third quarter of the year is typically the toughest for car makers. It's a seasonal thing. But not so at Volkswagen this year. Profits at the company that brought us the bug and then brought it back again jumped 45% in the latest quarter over last year. Volkswagen is interested in more than earnings, though. It's after world domination. And as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports, it has a tough road ahead.
In an old Volkswagen commercial, a couple is driving a Jetta. And all of a sudden, the world around them synchronizes.
Sometimes everything just comes together. On the road of life, there are passengers and there are drivers.
Volkswagen is a driver. The company is rapidly claiming more of the car market, especially in fast-growing economies like China. Peter DiLorenzo was a marketing exec in the auto industry for over 20 years.
Everyone expects Volkswagen will be the number one global automaker within 6 months.
Clearly, this is a great moment, a great time for Volkswagen. It's also a time fraught with risk.
Management consultant Dan McGinn says Volkswagen has become successful by building its brands. Pardon me while I name drop. Bentley, Bugatti, Lamborghini, Audi, and it's expected to close a deal with Porsche soon.
But the challenge of these multiple brands is that it gets harder every year.
Harder, McGinn says, to keep up quality and sales. General Motors is now number one, but it wasn't too long ago the company famously collapsed under the weight of its brands. Toyota, another former number one, also overexpanded. DiLorenzo says Volkswagen is well positioned to hold on to the top spot.
They have all the ingredients, they have all the brands, they have all segments of the market covered.
But even Volkswagen admits business may take a turn. Today, the company said it expects sluggish sales in Europe and overall car sales to be flat next year. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
What was up with the stock market today? Just about everything. Details when we do the numbers. You may have heard by now about the new immigration law in Alabama. It's one of the toughest, or critics complain, vaguest in the country. Among other things, police can demand documentation from anyone they reasonably expect is in the U.S. illegally. In the last week, one businessman has found himself at the center of the controversy in a spotlight he never anticipated or wanted. From WBHM in Birmingham, Tanya Ott reports.
Steve Dobrinsky moves swiftly between the meat cutter and the hot cooktop at Max's Delicatessen.
He's making matzo balls. What are you cooking here, Pedro?
Potatoes for vegetable soup.
Potatoes for the vegetable beef soup.
Dobrinsky opened his New York-style deli in a Birmingham suburb 3 years ago. He named it after his dad and poured his heart into the place.
7 days a week, 15-hour days at a minimum for 3 years. I think we're closed maybe 1 or 2 days a year, and that's it.
But earlier this month, Dobrinsky saw his dream unraveling. He was quoted in the Birmingham News saying he was worried he'd lose workers because of the new law. About half of his 19 employees are immigrants. Many have undocumented relatives in Alabama, and they want to move out of state. Other employees say they just don't feel comfortable or safe living in Alabama. The article led to a tangle with Matt Murphy, a libertarian talk show host on a Birmingham radio station.
You claim that you're comfortable that all of your employees are legal, and I don't believe you.
Well, you don't have
I think you know some of your employees are illegal. In fact, I've had people
For the
tell
record,
me that
Dobrinsky
personally...
admitted to me that he has, in the past, employed undocumented workers. But he claims he checked the paperwork for all of his current employees, and he believes they're all here legally. Still, callers to the radio show demanded a boycott of the restaurant. Max's Deli became the talk of anti-immigrant websites, and within a day, the internet was full of newly posted negative reviews for the restaurant.
The very next day, a couple empty tables at noon, and, you know, with the thoughts that run through your head, what the heck did I do?
Dobrinsky's email account was flooded with messages from around the country.
One of the emails I got was from a lady who said, I hope your un-American restaurant closes. You know, I had to have a sense of humor, otherwise I'd be crying. I said, I'll close tonight. And she wrote back, idiot, I mean forever.
The incident shows just how risky it can be for a business owner to take a stand on an issue. Stephen Kraft is dean of the business school at the University of Montevallo near Birmingham.
You hate to drive the voice of the small business out of public policy. However, for better or worse, it is predictable that there's going to be some repercussions when you weigh in on a controversial subject.
And the roller coaster ride continues. Dobrinsky says he's received hundreds of emails of support and 300 new Facebook friends for Max's Delicatessen. Still, he's weary from the experience and says he's not sure he wants to stay in the restaurant business. In Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Tanya Ott for Marketplace.
Coming up, sustainable meat and the reasons people pay for it.
Family farms, sustainable agricultural practices, highest level of animal welfare traceability, and never ever hormones or antibiotics.
But first, let's do the numbers. Ah, yeah, a deal on the Eurozone debt ignited global markets. The Dow Jones Industrial Average surged more than 400 points, then settled back to close up 339 points, or 2.8% at 12,208. The NASDAQ rose 87 points, 3.3% to finish at 2738. The S&P 500 gained 42 points, nearly 3.5% to end the day at 1284. No shocker that banks were among the biggest gainers. Morgan Stanley had labored under concerns about its European debt holdings. Today, that pall lifted, and Morgan shares zoomed up 17%. Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, and Citigroup each notched gains of more than 9%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering IRA savings products and a Raise Your Rate 4-year CD. Learn more at allybank.com. And by CenturyLink, a new kind of broadband company linking Americans coast to coast with consistently fast speeds and personal service. More at CenturyLink.com. Marketplace Innovation Reporting is supported by the 2012 Jaguar XJ. Learn more at a local dealer or at JaguarUSA.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for September. A symposium on the effects of military deployment on families takes place at the National Press Club. And she's one lady who's not afraid to share her age. The Statue of Liberty turns 125. Events tomorrow mark the anniversary of her dedication ceremony in 1886. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdo. For more than a month, Occupy Wall Street protesters have railed against the moneyed 1%. Well, now they have money of their own, thanks to a flood of donations. And that creates a challenge for a movement that's determined to be leaderless. Who controls the money and how? We've already seen one mishap in Portland where up to $20,000 in donations went missing. How about New York? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson follows the money.
Pete Ducho is at a bank near Zuccotti Park, depositing checks into Occupy Wall Street's official account. They're mostly for small amounts, $20, and some include notes.
To Occupy Wall Street folks, thank you for speaking out for us. Best, Zoe.
Ducho is one of six volunteers on the finance committee. In just over a month, Occupy Wall Street has received well over $400,000 in donations. The protest typically spends $2,000 to $3,000 a day, mostly on food. But with so much money coming in, Finance Committee member Daryl Prince says there's been a lot of attention from fellow protesters and outsiders.
So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of people watching, probably rightfully so.
After all, Prince says Occupy Wall Street is about economic injustice. So everybody gets a say. Any expense over $100 a day has to go before the whole group, which means a shocking amount of bureaucracy.
You get the form from finance, and then you get your working group consensus on it. And then you send your working group representative to finance with your proposal, and then you take it to the facilitation working group, and then you take it to General Assembly.
And that General Assembly is slow. It's haggled over purchases like walkie-talkies and storage bins. Last night, the Assembly voted to send $20,000 to fellow protesters in Oakland. And they're working to streamline the process. Finance member Prince tried to replace the petty cash box with plastic, but it backfired.
They sent us debit cards for each of the subcommittees with my name on all of them.
Sometimes money just wants a leader. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The Occupy Wall Street movement that started in New York is breathing some new life into a proposed city ordinance here in Los Angeles. It's a bid to squeeze more social contributions from the banks. Los Angeles Councilman Richard Alarcon is the man behind it.
You can think of it sort of as a municipal community reinvestment act. Then we would be able to compare these institutions against each other relative to the services that we would be requesting from them.
So before doing business with prospective banking partners, the city would first take a hard look at how they actually reinvest in the local community. Mr. Alarcon says we're talking about a lot of money here.
The city's general fund allocations annually are about $6 billion. The total, when you look at all the pension systems, is about $30 billion.
His responsible banking ordinance hadn't gained much traction, though, until the Occupy movement in Los Angeles gave it a new push. Now the city council's budget committee is set to take up the proposal next month. We sat down with Mr. Alarcon just as city budget planners have been raising fresh doubts about severing ties with major banks. In fact, the city's administrative officer just warned that this idea could cause L.A.'s borrowing costs to soar.
Well, first of all, the financial managers are the treasurer and the controller, not the CAO. The CAO is the budget analyst for the city of Los Angeles and makes recommendations. And I think their report is fundamentally flawed because he's suggesting that we're going to terminate existing agreements, which has nothing to do with the banking responsibility ordinance, which is prospective.
Yes, but the city administrative officer is also arguing that the role of city government should be to get the best deal for taxpayers and not rate banks on their social responsibility.
Well, he's thinking in a very transactional way, but in the global sense, we have a responsibility to take care of our constituents. And that includes not just looking at a specific transaction, but looking at the reinvestment into our community. Are we going to do business with a bank that doesn't invest in our small business community? Are we going to do a business with a bank that ripped off thousands and tens of thousands, if you will, of people in the foreclosure crisis? Are we going to work with a bank that doesn't contribute to local charities? No.
Now, I understand that you're getting some support from this Occupy Wall Street or Occupy LA movement to push this idea forward.
They brought it to a head. The measure had been dwindling through the city system for over 2 years, and it was it resurged when we incorporated into a resolution to support the Occupy LA movement, which, by the way, received a unanimous vote of 12-0.
Now, do you think the taxpayers would support this initiative, even if it might mean that they'd have to accept millions in cuts to city services? In other words, what price are people willing to pay?
First of all, you're dead wrong. There's not going to be any cuts to city services as a result of the banking responsibility ordinance. And in fact, I believe we're going to save money as a result of these measures by ensuring that the banks are providing more services to the community than less. I'm not suggesting that we cut our ties completely with anybody. All I'm saying is that we should demand that they act more responsibly with regard to taking our money and then reinvesting it in our community.
Richard Alarcon is a Los Angeles City Council member. Thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
How do you define sustainability? It can have two very distinct meanings in business. The first, as you might expect, is how much good or harm a company is doing to everyday human life and the environment. The second is simply, how long can it keep doing that? In other words, is the business sustainable? Sometimes out in the real world, those two goals, being green and making enough green, don't exactly get along. Marketplace's Eve Tro has a case in point from our sustainability desk.
Nyman Ranch started when Bill Nyman raised a few cows on a chunk of Northern California coast.
I guess I'd like to say my business plan was whoever called on the telephone.
Who called? Chefs from around the country, crazy for his marbled meat.
The focus was really about creating a brand and creating the best tasting, most wholesome and wonderful food, and felt that eventually you would become profitable.
Today, Nyman Ranch works with about 700 farmers. It sells beef, pork, lamb, chicken, eggs, and prepared foods like bacon and hot dogs. If you see a proper name in front of the word pork chop on a menu, it's likely Nyman Ranch. About 4 years ago, Bill Nyman felt too much tension between sustainability and profitability. He quit, about a year after Jeff Swain became CEO.
And I came in with some other investors to help inject capital and give it a chance to become financially sustainable.
Nyman Ranch had never turned a profit. Now sales are strong. In fact, the company could sell a lot more meat.
Demand has outstripped supply for the last 3 years.
But Swain says the brand's value comes from its efforts to do good.
The tenets of our brand, family farms, sustainable agricultural practices, highest level of animal welfare, traceability, and never ever hormones or antibiotics. And that restricts our growth.
Every year, Nyman Ranch brings investors, meat distributors, restaurant owners, and chefs to one of its Iowa farms. They see how the pigs live, outside, rolling in the dirt. The vice president of pork, John Peterson, shows them a map with hundreds of pushpins, one for each farm. He explains how Nyman Ranch coordinates transportation and processing, and why there might be hiccups in supply.
So I know that it's very frustrating at times, especially in the summer when we get short on pork. But think about the complexity of that operation to try and get them all to the right place at the right time from 500 different farms.
Many of those farmers are only raising pigs at all because of Nyman Ranch incentives, 11 cents a pound above the pork commodity market. At dusk, the city slickers all go for a hayride. The tractor gets stuck in deep mud.
Send the bus!
I walk back through tall prairie grass with Isaac McGannum. His family owns a California chain called Burgermeister. He says they've had trouble getting Nyman Ranch bacon in the past. Supply is secure now, but the family is adding more locations.
As we grow as a business, not to mention as Nyman grows as a model, if they are going to be able to keep up with the demand, are they going to adhere to their husbandry principles?
Some clients wonder if the company principles match their customers' ever-shifting concerns. A meat distributor asks hog director Mark Lane whether the pig feed comes from genetically modified plants. Lane says, well, 90% of corn and soy feed crops are GMO.
If we were going to go to a non-GMO product,
and that would move that production cost quite a bit higher.
Special feed would cost too much. Environmental and financial sustainability collide over issues like these. Companies can't afford to pursue every best practice. Nyman Ranch has had to prioritize. But the ranch founder, Bill Nyman, says his former companies lost distinction.
I think in terms of comparison to the other natural brands out there, it's as good. It's not worse. It's not better.
He left Nyman Ranch because he couldn't sign off on certain practices, like outsourcing butchering and animal transport. He admits that doing everything in-house was something dear to him that didn't necessarily add value for most customers.
If the consumer in the marketplace is not going to reward you with a premium for this more expensive or controlled production model, then you better be like the other guys.
Bill Nyman doesn't want to be like any other guys.
That calf was just born this morning. Probably weighs 65, 70 pounds, which is ideal.
He started a new company called BN Ranch, raising cattle with a new goal.
Prove that grass-fed can be every bit as good as the best grain-finished beef.
The less corn and soy animals eat, the better it is for the topsoil, he says. I ask if he's nervous about building this new company.
Well, it needs to grow, and we're approaching some of the same thoughtful people that funded the startup of Nyman Ranch because they know me and they know what I stand for and they know what we're doing.
He doesn't know if he'll ever get to the size or market share or success that Nyman Ranch has today. But that's not his goal. He's restarted to test the limits of profit and passion. I'm Eve Trow for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Their new book, How to Eat Weekends, is available now at bookstores nationwide. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note, picking up where we left off a while ago on the finances behind the Occupy Wall Street movement. In the capital city of Virginia, a Tea Party group is complaining that it was unfairly charged for its rallies at a plaza in Richmond. But now Occupy protesters have been allowed to use the same space several weeks for free. The Tea Partiers are demanding a refund of about $10,000 for the permits, portable toilets, and emergency personnel they were required to pay for. Occupy Atlanta protesters are facing similar finger-pointing. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow surged 339 points, or 2.8%. The Nasdaq rose 87 points, 3.3%. The S&P 500 gained 42 points, nearly 3.5%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Hawes, Patty Hirsch, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And tomorrow on The Big Show, yes, more analysis on Greece and the rest of the EU via the weekly wrap. Plus a talk with sci-fi film director Andrew Niccol about his new film, In Time. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai back here for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.